I'm Robin Young. It's here and now, and it was to be expected. The death toll from China's massive 7.9 magnitude earthquake has climbed to over 12,000, with tens of thousands still buried under debris. Veteran NPR producer Art Silverman saw hundreds of survivors near the epicenter of the earthquake in China's Sichuan province.
We saw them out there today on a miserable rainy day under makeshift tarps, whole families, people cooking under there. Miles and miles of that. And shops closed. The one thing that seemed consistent here was that urban activity never stopped, and this made it stop. That stood out in my mind.
One Chinese official said so far only 58 people have been pulled alive from the rubble of scores of flattened buildings. A day after the quake, President Bush expressed his condolences to the president of China and offered an initial $500,000 in earthquake relief aid. And two groups of British and American tourists touring the wildlife refuge that's home to giant pandas remain out of contact. Officials say the pandas themselves may have known to climb to higher ground. Well, for the latest on what's happening, we turn first to Peter Goff. He's the Irish co-owner of the China Bookworm. That's a chain of three English lending libraries in China. He's based in Chengdu, which is about 55 miles from the epicenter of the quake. Peter, where have you been and what have you seen?
I've been in and around the vicinity of Chengdu, which is the capital of Sichuan province, for the past few days. Chengdu itself is a big city of 10 million people. A lot of high-rises. It was hit fairly hard with the quake. The buildings were shaking wildly, but remarkably, for being only 55 miles away from such a massive quake, buildings have, by and large, in the city itself, remained intact. But I think the last death toll for Chengdu was 45. A very different story outside the city. I've been into a place called Dujiangyan today, which is about 15 miles from the epicenter. There are tens of thousands of people on the street who are now homeless. The death toll in that region is 12,000, but that figure is clearly going to double, triple over the next coming days. There are reports of one city alone that has 18,000 people under rubble. Today I witnessed soldiers just taking corpse after corpse after corpse out of demolished buildings and houses, schools, and shopping complexes.
You know, you're one of many in the expat community that's responding. How is the expat community there responding?
They're responding very well and very quickly. The scenes up there are chaotic, and it's carnage, of course. And there is some rescue. There are rescue operations going on. There is some food supply and so on. But it's been sent up through official channels, but it's obviously so soon that it's not enough. So people here are using drop-off centres. They're getting up dried foods. They're getting up blankets and they're getting tents and whatever they can get, and getting people out of that zone. It's still very dangerous up there. There are buildings coming down to up there today, and several buildings were collapsing during the rescue operations and so on. So people are getting out of there. So there's a sort of shuttling service to get people back into the cities and into a safer environment.
Well, now, do you feel safe? I mean, you're away from, a little bit further away from the epicenter, but we understand you've been sleeping outside at night. What's the thinking where you are as to what happens next?
Well, there's a bit of a scientific anomaly here. I think when the first quake was 7.9, and then it went down and down and down to a 5-something, but then it came back with a 6.2 today, which doesn't usually happen, apparently. And so seismologists are warning that this could be a strange situation, and that people should exercise extreme care, that there could be a bigger quake coming back again. And, of course, structures have already been weakened over the past 2 days, so there's quite a bit of concern here. So people are generally staying in open areas, sports grounds and open squares and so on, away from high-rise buildings.
You've been sleeping outside?
In cars, tents, that kind of thing, yep.
Yeah. What kind of injuries do people have? You know, you've been up in the area where buildings have collapsed. What kinds of injuries are aid groups going to have to deal with?
Obviously a lot of gashes, broken bones and so on, injuries of that kind. And then there's the after effects of people not getting, I guess, access to drinking water and not getting enough food. And there's a disease spread, threats of diseases spreading very quickly and so on.
Are you actually seeing that or hearing of it?
No, that's a concern that the Chinese aids groups have raised, that will happen if refugees are sort of in camps for any length of time without access to proper sanitation and so on. But the hospitals here are jam-packed. The lobbies of a hospital in this morning had like something that you couldn't even walk into the counter because there were so many mattresses on the ground where people were lying on the ground on the ground floor of the reception of the hospital, and in the corridors too. So the beds are way oversubscribed, of course. So it's a pretty dire situation. There's going to be a lot of humanitarian work needed.
Mm-hmm. When you're confronted with, as you said, you walk into places where, you know, thousands of people are milling about with injuries, what can you do?
It's just get on with life. It was the most deeply disturbing thing I think I've seen ever, probably. And people are bewildered. They're sort of they're walking around. It's almost like they're in a little bit sort of zombie-like. So it's just a matter of some people just pulling it together, just moving on, getting things done, just trying to do the little bit they can do, and just make life better for a few people around. Mm. It's very difficult. People are just aghast. They're just walking around wide-eyed, and it's very, very quiet, and it's eerie. But between everyone, the work needs to be done just to bring this tragedy to an end.
Bring water? Or, you know, you as an individual, put a cloth on a cut? I mean, it's, you know...
Yeah, well, literally at this stage, it's very ad hoc, and it's like that. There are people who are just, like, in the local taxi drivers here last night, all went out there and picked up people and brought them into train stations and into cities, obviously free of charge. The university students here are going out and bringing in, you know, fruit and drinking water and stuff, and the international community is giving donations where they can and getting in sort of medical care. So people are responding wherever they can, but it's very ad hoc and it's very small level. It's such a massive catastrophe, so it needs to be obviously administered by somebody of the caliber of the UN or the Red Cross or whatever.
Is the Red Cross there?
They say they're going to be in within the next couple of days. It takes them some days to mobilize.
Yeah. Peter Goth, thank you so much for speaking with us, and please be safe.
Thank you very much, Robin.
That's Peter Goff, the Irish co-owner of the China Bookworm. That's a chain of English lending libraries in China. He spoke to us from Chengdu, China. Well, Melinda Liu is Beijing bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. She's in Beijing. Melinda, you're straddling two stories, the cyclone in Burma and the devastating earthquake in China. How has the earthquake affected China's aid to Burma? Because, of course, China is a major ally of Burma's.
Right, and of course the relief effort here in China is huge. It's just enormous. The government has set aside $100 million for the relief effort, and I wouldn't say that it's taken away materially from the cyclone relief efforts in Burma, but of course China is a major international patron of the Burmese regime. And, you know, in China, the government is just completely preoccupied now with its own problems.
Right.
I can't imagine this is doing great things for Burma, because the international community was hoping to actually use pressure on China to try to get China to get the Burmese generals to open up a little more and be a little more forthcoming about accepting relief assistance.
The world, as you said, was pressuring China to help Myanmar, Burma, and China might be looking to help Burma for many reasons, for public relations. You know, it's had sort of a black eye because of the criticism of its treatment of Tibet, and that came up during the Olympic torch relay. But China and Burma are, you know, pretty symbiotic in other ways, economic ways as well.
Absolutely. China is very much the big brother to Burma, you know, in the international community, and the protector of Burma's interest in, say, the United Nations. And I've got to say, Burma, in more recent days, has opened up slightly more. You know, the U.S. Is bringing in some relief assistance now, but still very, very, very inadequate in terms of what's needed there. The difference here is that China has a much better infrastructure to implement its own relief program. You know, they've mobilized the military, which was there from minute one, opposed to Burma, where the soldiers were sort of missing in action for the first couple of days, very low key, or spotted cleaning up areas near military families or military areas, but not in the general community. It's very obvious that China, having gone out on a limb to protect Burma's interests by not wanting to have the international community push too hard, cannot afford to be seen to be laggardly in its own relief efforts here.
And it's in China's interest to help Burma. China gets a lot of its natural gas and hardwood from Burma. It sees Burma as a, you know, military access to the sea beyond, and in fact, it's building a pipeline.
Absolutely. Burma is critical to the Chinese strategic energy policy. It has become a very important base or node in China's need to have a pipeline that goes towards the Indian Ocean that allows energy imports, that helps strengthen the very extended sort of oil supply line that China relies on.
The Chinese government is now saying that it welcomes outside aid, again, very different from Burma, although it doesn't want personnel to go into the affected areas because then, you know, they're saying they might have to protect the aid personnel, but they will take funds and supplies. Another, you know, it pales in comparison, but we're thinking also about the Olympic torch relay. Is it going to continue as planned because it was scheduled to go through the area where the quake is?
That's right, and that's another example of how this disaster has shaken the government and maybe pressed home some much more fundamental concerns. Now we've had this disaster in Sichuan, and already the Olympic organizers have said that they will scale back the torch relay because, as you pointed out, it was due to go through Chengdu, the provincial capital of the province that was mainly affected. The fact that they are willing to put the welfare of the people and the relief effort above, you know, the sort of symbolic PR aspects of the torch relay, I think is appropriate, and I think a lot of people would say this is the right priority.
Well, and they may not be able to do that in the way they wanted, but there may be a side effect of the earthquake, which is that China is being so open about its own earthquake as opposed to in the past. Perhaps that might influence Burma.
Yes, I think there is something very interesting along those lines happening now in China. We've seen some extraordinarily public and I think hoping to appear transparent even, actions by the government. The premier was on his way to the disaster area, you know, within a very short time after the earthquake. We've seen the state-run media on the television talking to pundits, you know, calling people in the affected area. So we're seeing quite proactive, I would call it, you know, public relations in some ways. But, of course, it's also meant to reassure the people.
We understand there were pictures of Premier Wen Jiabao using a bullhorn, you know, reminiscent of post-9/11 in the U.S., but using a bullhorn, telling people factories can be rebuilt. It's people we care about.
Yes, exactly. And, in fact, sometimes, you know, you could look at some of these photographs, and they, for me anyway, they were very evocative of 9/11.
Newsweek magazine's Melinda Liu in Beijing. Melinda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, when we come back, why so many natural disasters? We're hearing reports that many Burmese believe that natural disasters mean their rulers are no longer in favor with the heavens. But there's also a natural explanation, not the gods, but the mangroves, as we'll hear. And later today, a veteran John McCain watcher says he's not the man who fought for campaign finance reform. We'll hear that as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we have more now on Burma. A spokesperson for the UN in Thailand says there's a lot of frustration that the aid effort in Burma hasn't picked up. There are reports that the military is keeping the better quality food and supplies that are coming in, and logistical issues and bottlenecks at the borders are also slowing the efforts. Burma's cyclone was huge, more powerful than many analysts realize, but one of the reasons it was able to cause so much damage is that mangroves that once protected coastal villages from tidal surges and winds have been destroyed. Aaron Ellison is a senior ecologist and research fellow at the Harvard Forest in Petersham, Massachusetts. He's an expert on mangroves. So, Aaron, remind us first, what exactly is a mangrove?
A mangrove is a general term for a salt-tolerant tree or shrub that grows on the sheltered coasts in the tropics or in the subtropics, as long as it doesn't freeze. It's not any particular kind of tree or plant. There are about 70 species overall of mangroves in the world, four of which grow in the United States. But mangrove is also the term that we use to describe tropical coastal forests made up of these trees. You can think of them as sort of the salt marshes of the tropics.
Right. And I picture them, and I'm maybe I'm wrong, but I picture sort of like an Everglades look in that they can sometimes have roots above the water.
That's exactly right. They have the roots above the water so that they can get the oxygen out of the atmosphere or out of the surrounding water that they need, because otherwise there's not any oxygen in the water-saturated soils.
Right. Well, I want our listeners to know I'm looking at two NASA satellite photos of Burma, and they can do the same if they go to our website, here-now.org. We'll link you up. One is taken just before the cyclone hit on May 3rd. The other is taken 2 days later, and there's a dramatic difference that you can just see the water, how it's washed over the land. I mean, it just doesn't seem as if there was anything blocking its way.
That's really right. I mean, basically, it washed over everywhere that's by the coast, and that washover seems to have been a bit more dramatic where the mangroves were cut.
As I look at these images, I see green and brown where there was land, and now there's like white, puffy. They almost look like clouds, but we understand that they are water covering, you know, huge swaths of that land. I see sort of these colors. What do you see, given that you know?
Oh, I see basically the same thing. And what's really striking on this image, the two things that really jumped out at me first was that the old capital, Yangon.
Rangoon.
It used to be called Rangoon. Was right at the mouth of a river, and it was really vulnerable to this kind of storm surge. And I don't know what the figures are coming out of Myanmar right now, but it can't be very good for Yangon.
So tell us, why were mangroves destroyed, and over what period of time?
Mangroves have been destroyed as long as there have been people living near them. In fact, throughout the world, mangroves are being cut down at about 1 to 2% per year, faster than the rate at which tropical rainforests are being cut down.
Why? What do people want the trees for, or what do they want to put in their place?
Well, really, it's mostly they want to live there. About half of the world's 6.5 billion people live within 100 miles of a coast, and eight of the world's 10 biggest cities, including those with big mangroves like Lagos, Calcutta, Mumbai, and Sao Paulo, have all basically been created out of mangrove swamps.
We understand, too, that between 1924 and 1999, many of the mangrove swamps were used for rice cultivation, and in part because the British colonizers initially wanted them there.
That's right. I mean, part of it was used for rice cultivation. Part of it now is being used for shrimp farming, all those tiger prawns that we get in the restaurant and at the grocery store. The people in country use the wood for charcoal. And mangrove wood is used to manufacture rayon. It's some of the highest grade wood pulp usable for rayon manufacture in the world.
Huh. And so, again, I mean, it would seem simple that the mangrove trees with their roots coming up act as sort of a filter and slow down water flow from cyclone-driven water. But why else do mangroves protect a coastline?
Well, so mangroves protect the coastline just like salt marshes protect the coastline. They slow down the water that moves through the system. They trap sediment to reduce coastal erosion. And because they're basically a big object in the face of storm surge, they reduce the energy of the water and the wind moving through the mangroves and through the forest.
Well, and one of the things they do in cyclones is slow down the wind.
That's correct.
Right. It has been said that studies showed that mangroves slowed down the water in the tsunami. Is that true?
In some places, that does appear to be true. There was good information out of Sri Lanka and Tamil Nadu in India that villages behind intact mangroves suffered much fewer deaths than villages that had cut all their mangroves down. But additional research has also shown that it may be just as important where those villages are built relative to the coastline and how quickly the bottom of the ocean comes up to the land and sort of funnels the water up to the land. And that can be as important as the presence or absence of mangroves or other vegetation.
So this is feeling so much like the conversation we had post-Katrina about how the wetlands had been destroyed that surrounded New Orleans and acted as the same kind of buffer. And in that case, people are talking about maybe trying to put some back, recover some wetlands. Can you reverse the trend in the case of the mangroves? Can they be brought back?
There's very good work being done throughout the world in restoration of mangroves, some of the best being done here in the United States, in Florida, as well as in Louisiana and Texas. A lot of replanting has gone on in Indonesia after the tsunami in 2004. that work has to keep going. And at the same time, we have to protect the mangroves that are still there because they're already there and they're growing a lot better than the very small plants that will take decades to grow that are now being planted.
In one case, Bangladesh has actually reversed the problem and increased their mangrove cover.
That's right. Bangladesh has done a really good job reversing its mangrove cover.
Who paid for that?
Partly the NGOs and the United Nations, partly the government there. They did lose a huge number of people in cyclones in the 1970s and have done an enormous amount of replanting work to try and avoid those kinds of disasters again in the future.
Aaron Ellison, Senior Ecologist and Research Fellow at Harvard Forest in Petersham, Massachusetts. Thank you so much.
You bet.
And of course, we'll continue to bring you stories about both Burma and China in the wake of the two natural disasters in that part of the world. But still to come today, closer to home, how graduation has gone global. We'll hear how a college dean is determined to get her students' names right at their big moment. And also tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to speak with poet Nikki Giovanni. You want to hear that as well. Back after the news, Here and Now. Hillary Clinton has hopes that a big win over Barack Obama in today's primary in West Virginia, combined with a big win in Kentucky next week, will keep her candidacy going. Obama will be in Missouri tonight, and that's considered a bellwether state in the fall campaign. Ultimately, the Democratic nominee will face the presumptive Republican nominee, John McCain, although there's a potential wild card there. Former Republican Congressman Bob Barr has launched a bid to run for president as a Libertarian, and he could peel votes from McCain. Well, journalist Elizabeth Drew is well-positioned to talk about John McCain. She's covered him for more than a decade and documented his successful fight for campaign finance reform in her 2002 book, Citizen McCain. At the time, reviewers marveled at his unyielding fight, his willingness to attract enemies in pressing his cause, including George Bush, a useful expose of how things get done in Washington, said one review. Well, that book is out in paperback for the first time with a new introduction, and Elizabeth Drew joins us from her home in Washington. Elizabeth, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Well, tell us right away, is this the John McCain you were watching in 2002?
Not really, to be quite honest. John McCain was faced with a big dilemma. There was no way he could be nominated by the Republican Party if he stayed with his independent, largely centrist views that had evolved from 2000 through about 2002. So the John McCain that so many people came to admire, the principal John McCain, the John McCain who said what he thought, evolved into someone else in that he had to play, or he felt he had to play, I think that's important, to the conservative Christian right base of the Republican Party. There is an argument, and I've heard it from a very smart pollster and political strategist who's close to McCain. This person argued with McCain before he began this last campaign for the nomination that he didn't have to go to the right.
Well, for instance, you point out that, and we've mentioned on the program, that John McCain once called the conservative evangelicals agents of intolerance, and then there he was agreeing to give the commencement speech at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University in 2006. We remember him in the robes. But you write it didn't appear to do him any good politically.
No, it didn't. It didn't really get him the support of the Christian right. And he's still having a little trouble nailing down some of those people. He'll have enough when we get to November. But he was kind of making all sorts of gestures, and sometimes not gestures. Sometimes his votes on certain pieces of legislation were very troubling to admirers or former admirers of him.
Such as?
One example would be the Military Commissions Act, which he supported. Among the things this bill did was to remove habeas corpus from resident aliens, all resident aliens in the United States, and it put into place this military tribunals system that really was very tough on the rights of the prisoners of particularly Guantanamo. And another was when he voted against a Democratic proposal to make the CIA interrogators hew to the same torture standards as are in the military field manual for regular military people. And the administration was very strongly against Democrats' bill. But that was one thing. It was quite another for John McCain, who had earned so many people's admiration for his taking a strong stand earlier against the administration on the subject of torture.
But as you point out, and others have as well, he fought that battle with President Bush to get torture outlawed in the military, but then, you know, didn't say anything when President Bush turned around and signed a signing statement which said that he had the right to overturn that legislation.
Yes, that's right. So this, too, was a sign that this man was changing before our very eyes.
Elizabeth Drew, it really is something to read your book about the 2002 fight for campaign finance reform against Citizen McCain, and to see the hard battle he fought for something that Republicans really didn't want in particular, but then to be reminded, as you do remind us, of that famous photograph. It's called The Hug, and this was in 2004, and what a shock that was to people who had watched him just 2 years earlier battle for campaign finance reform. Remind us of that picture.
Bush and McCain were in Pensacola, Florida, and McCain had agreed to help Bush campaign for re-election. Bush was caught in a very tight re-election fight with John Kerry. So he needed McCain. McCain needed Bush if he was going to run for the nomination again. So the famous picture was of the two men in shirt sleeves. It was a serious hug. McCain sort of resting his head against Bush's shoulder and Bush kind of giving him a peck on the forehead. That was the sign that things were going to be different now. And I remember saying to a friend, well, if John McCain goes down that road, he won't be John McCain anymore. And that's, I'm afraid, what's happened.
Well, and to remind us further, not just that they had battled over campaign finance, but of course had battled as candidates in 2000, when John McCain was so smeared by allegations, these terrible rumors that his adopted daughter, who's from India, was an illegitimate black child.
That is what led to, actually, to his Agents of Intolerance speech, because some of the churches had been involved, or the Christian right groups had been involved in this campaign against him. But as I say in the book, the deft Paul knows that at some point you have to move on, especially if you have the goal that McCain did, which was the highest political stakes this country has. So he was ready to put that behind him and to try to make amends.
But if his core, those who embraced him because they thought he was a moderate Republican, is turned off by, you know, his embrace of the war or embrace of the evangelicals, and Republicans, and you say, you know, it's safe to say Karl Rove hates John McCain, and many Republicans waged that smear campaign against him in 2000. If they reject him because they're not buying the new John McCain, they still think he's a moderate, where does that leave him?
Well, let me amend one of the things, and that is that Rove hated McCain. It sure seemed that way to me from when I talked to Rove about him. In fact, I went to see Rove on another matter, and he just brought up McCain. I wasn't writing about McCain then. But Rove's flexible, too, and they've both made their peace, and in fact, Rove is now an advisor to his campaign. I think where this will be troublesome for McCain is that he and Obama will be fighting over independence. I've looked at McCain very, very closely. It'll be up to Obama, who we also see is a pretty tough fellow himself, to bring out their differences and debate him on it. I think this is going to be a very strong election with two very smart, tough men fighting each other.
Well, interesting. As many people have, you've concluded that it will be two men.
Yes.
Journalist Elizabeth Drew, her book Citizen McCain is just out in paperback with a new introduction. Elizabeth, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome, Robin.
Okay, before we go today, Israel's Academy of the Hebrew Language. You're listening to Here and Now. This weekend, many college seniors will make that walk across the stage to collect their diplomas. They've come this far. What could go wrong? Ask Sue Alexander. She's Dean of Students at Wheaton College in Norton, Massachusetts. We were surprised to find out how much thought she puts into pronouncing graduates' names. Dean Alexander joins us in the studio. We understand your school has a commencement rehearsal. Now, right there, you impress us. You rehearse. Why?
Names are bestowed lovingly at the time of birth. Many students go through life, particularly if they have polysyllabic names, having had their names butchered through their educational experience. And I think it's important at this final moment when they cross the stage for the students and their families to have their names proclaimed in a way that sounds familiar to those who love them.
And I understand the very first name when you arrived at the school set you on this path.
It was the name of a proud Palestinian woman. And when I asked her how to pronounce her name, she looked at me evenly and said, Suher Abdarrahman Abdarrazak. And it was very clear to me that I was expected to say it correctly, and that did set me on my path.
As you did just now. During that rehearsal we mentioned, you ask each student to say their name, but you also ask them to come and speak to you privately if they have issues. And they do line up. What are some of the things they say to you?
Most often they might say, don't read my middle name. And I'll say, what is your middle name? And they'll say, oh, it's my grandmother's family name. I say, is your grandmother coming to commencement? Wouldn't she like to hear that name read?
Yeah, so there's some counseling involved.
The second thing that students will often say, if I make a first attempt at saying their name and miss, is, oh, that's good enough.
And you say, no, let's get it right.
Exactly.
And can you give us, I don't know if they come to you easily, but some of the names over the years that resonate for you.
Beata Bogomila Lozinski, Levant Kuşukresulu, a Turkish name that was probably my biggest hurdle, Georgina Sotiriadis Kirikos, Athanasios Dimitrios Kosmopoulos.
Oh, it's great to hear. You know, when you hear them, there is something noble about getting them right.
Indeed.
Let's hear some more.
Obina Onyewuchi Nwadike, Omonike Si Akinkwowo. And one of the ones that was hardest for me to get last year, Tanya Ayo Asare Smith. And I should have been able to say it, but it wasn't Tanya, it was Tania. And it wasn't Asare, it was Asare. So I really had to listen to her say it several times.
And this is what you do. You practice the whole list several times before you actually deliver it.
I do.
What does this list tell you?
It tells me that we are having more and more students, the millennial generation, whose parents have kept their respective names. And so we have many students with hyphenated last names now, far more than ever before.
Another thing I'm realizing it tells us about Americans in general is that there was a time when you came to America, you allowed officials to change your name.
Indeed.
Yeah. And now people are holding on to their real names.
Yes, and in fact, students who are adoptees have also kept both their original names, Korean name perhaps, and also their English name. And so we have a student graduating this year whose name is Leanne Sunhwa Sunaku Cyphers.
And you're going to get that right. You keep it at a certain clip?
We do, and one of the reasons for that is there are folks there who are perhaps the class clown and who always, there's always a great hoop and holler that goes up as those students cross the platform. And then there's the student who has studiously done his or her work and is not as well known, and they take that long, lonely walk across the platform with a small round of applause. And so we keep students moving at a fairly regular clip, and everyone rides that wave of applause across the platform.
That's Sue Alexander, Dean of Students at Wheaton College in Norton, Massachusetts. She's been reading the names of graduating seniors for 20 years. And this graduation, by the way, may be your last?
It will be my last. I'm retiring in June.
Ah, your thoughts about all those names.
Well, there is a litany of amazing individuals in whose lives I have been privileged to share. And so that is my last gift to them as they cross the platform.
Get their name right. Dean, thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, this song gets me every time. Back in a minute, Here and Now. Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush is heading to the Middle East tonight. First stop is Israel, where he'll address the Knesset and mark the 60th anniversary of Israel's founding. The peace process will also be discussed. He'll meet with President Ehud Olmert tomorrow, and later in the week in Egypt, he'll meet with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Yesterday, we looked back at the complicated history leading to Israel's founding. Today, a lighter aspect of Israeli life, and one that's still very much a work in progress. Language. Hebrew has a rich and deep history, but when lifestyle meets language, as Daniel Estrin reports, there are some linguistic logistics to resolve.
If you've got a suggestion for a new Hebrew word, Karen Dubnov wants to hear about it.
If I go here to my sent items.
Karen's in charge of the email hotline at the Academy of the Hebrew Language in Jerusalem.
Very recently we had a good suggestion for baby leaves for salad. Seems to be very well formulated, and we really need a word for baby leaves. If you go to the supermarket, go to the vegetables and look for that, there is no word but baby.
Israelis call it just baby?
Yeah, in all the stores, which is very unclear to a Hebrew speaker, I think.
Are you buying leaves or are you buying a baby?
Yeah.
Karen liked the suggestion for baby lettuce, so she passed it along to the Committee for Words in Daily Use. It's now under review. She wouldn't tell me what the word is.
I still cannot pronounce it loudly because it was not discussed yet, and it's not permitted to talk about it.
Okay, so at this point, there's still no word for baby lettuce. But that's not so bad, considering that just 100 years ago, most people didn't speak Hebrew at all. Except, of course, to God. Today, Hebrew's come a long way.
It is really unprecedented. There is no example in the history of languages that a language which was really not spoken for 1700 years, to being revived and being a language of all spheres of life. There's no example of this anywhere in the world.
Gabriel Birnbaum is a senior researcher at the Academy of the Hebrew Language. He says there are a few examples of revitalized languages around the world, Maori in New Zealand, Welsh in Wales, but their success pales in comparison to Hebrew.
So now, of course, the question is why, and why it happens.
The real push came from a 23-year-old immigrant from Lithuania who thought that Jews returning to their ancestral homeland should speak their ancestral language. His name? This Israeli hit of the 1970s celebrating Eliezer Ben Yehuda calls him an amusing Jew. That's an understatement. His contemporaries thought he was completely crazy. The last time anyone spoke Hebrew in day-to-day conversation was back in the 2nd century, when the Romans destroyed the Second Temple and the exiled Israelites abandoned Hebrew for other languages. By the turn of the 20th century, Zionists were publishing periodicals in Hebrew, but no one was really speaking it for day-to-day conversation. That is, until Ben Yehuda arrived in Jerusalem in 1881. His efforts began at home. He and his wife took an oath to speak Hebrew, and only Hebrew, in the house. And then along came their son Itamar. Being the first Hebrew-speaking baby didn't make for such a happy childhood.
He says here in his memoirs that one of the things, he just wanted to go out to play with the children, to see the birds, to see the flowers.
But his father kept him on a tight leash. After all, the neighborhood kids spoke French, Russian, Yiddish, Arabic, so they were just a bad influence, not to mention the adults. Even the child's mother proved to be a danger for the language immersion experiment.
One day, Ben Yehuda was away, and his mother sang to him a lullaby in Russian, because that's what she knew. And when he came home, all of a sudden he heard that he was so angry. He says, you ruin now everything that we did, and how could you do this? So it was really a terrible thing.
But one Russian lullaby couldn't stop the spread of Hebrew. Ben Yehuda managed to convince a few other families to take the Hebrew oath. He started a Hebrew newspaper, except there was no Hebrew word for newspaper. So he made one up, Iton. He went on to coin hundreds of new words, from ice cream and omelet to soldier and bicycle. He'd slip the words into his newspaper articles, and his readers would adopt them. And he formed a Hebrew language committee, which published lists of new words for the Jewish community. That committee was the predecessor to today's Academy of the Hebrew Language. Researcher Gabriel Birnbaum says that coining and voting on new words is the easy part. Getting Israelis to actually adopt them is a whole other story.
The There's a lot of blunders, if you can call that. I mean, we have at least 100,000 words, and many, many of them are, they're just not used because people, it's very difficult to change people's linguistic habits. I mean, we had a beautiful word for ringtone. It's a very new thing, ne'imon, but it doesn't seem to catch.
The Academy has language counselors that work with radio and TV newsrooms. Whenever there's a new word, they encourage editors to include it in the broadcast. Sometimes the editors agree, and the word slowly trickles down from the anchor to the masses. But more often than not, the new word just ends up on the cutting room floor.
The word for jingle. The word for jingle also, we had a beautiful, in my opinion, it's subjective, the word zamrir. Zamrir, it's a nice word. Comes from the zemer. Zemer is a song. So it's like a little song, zamrir. No, they said no. They even say it's a nice word, but we can't use it.
Talking to people on the street, you start to see what the Academy is up against. The Academy recently made up a few new words. One of them is zamrir.
Zamrir, what does it mean?
Zamrir is a jingle. What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't think it would catch. I can't imagine people going around and saying, oh, I heard that new zamrir and it's great. Zamrir. I don't like it.
From what I've heard, I don't think there's really a point to. I think they're just wasting their time and resources. There's like an academy for making up new words. That's kind of pathetic.
They're not very important for our lives, and they make stupid words.
Some ultra-Orthodox Jews are particularly outraged by the whole project. In fact, they objected to the use of Hebrew from the very beginning. To them, modernizing the Holy Tongue was blasphemous. So they stoned Ben Yehuda's house and excommunicated his family in protest. Today, much of the community sticks to Yiddish. But the Academy still keeps busy. Israelis are constantly making up new words themselves, and the language hotline receives suggestions almost daily. How many emails did you get today?
30, and the day's not over.
Wow.
It's regular. The approximate number per day is 40.
Let's go through today's inbox and see what you got.
The most funny letter for today was about a two-year-old girl who formatted a new word, a new Hebrew word for pedal of a bicycle.
Really?
She was not aware of the existing terminology. She's only two, okay?
People write in wanting help naming their babies, composing their wedding invitations, and proofreading tombstone inscriptions. Book publishers want to know official spellings, lawyers want to know official grammar, and Karen spends hours writing back to each and every one of them.
Here, people are completely in love with the language. They ask all the time. Many of them trust the Academy as if it was Hashem, God.
The revival of Hebrew may be one of the most successful linguistic experiments of modern times. That said, if Moses rose from his grave and visited Israel today, he'd need a translator. There are 8,000 different words written in the Bible, but there are about 80,000 words in a modern Hebrew dictionary. It seems that Israelis have more to talk about than just covenants, cherubs, and concubines.